This episode of Yes But Why Podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
I was 8 years old, and me and my dad would have guy time on the weekends, and because my dad is quiet and I was also quiet, what he would do is take me to this place in Tulsa, Oklahoma that's no longer there, called Steve Sunday's. Get a BLT, some chips, milkshake or a soda, and then I would get movie magazines.
Like entertainment or like...
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, okay. The thing that caught my interest into movies was this magazine called Cinescape. The issue emblazoned on the cover said sci-fi goes to war, and there's a stormtrooper on the front. The background is red. It sticks out in my mind so boldly. Star Wars was literally the first movie that I ever saw. My mom tells stories that if she needed to go take a shower, she'd just put me down in front of the TV and just play Star Wars 20 minutes at a time. So there's not even a point where I remember watching Star Wars for the first time. Star Wars predates my memory. I've watched it so many times. So I was interested in Star Wars. I saw this magazine. I got the magazine. And at the end of the thing, there's a list of all of the movies that are in development, which boggles my mind. And they were listing stuff for Star Wars Episode 1, Terminator 3, Bill and Ted 3, Planet of the Apes remake starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. All of these movies, and I went, I didn't even know that this was a thing. I can know whenever movies that I want to see are coming up. I think a little bit down there, I went, this is power. I have a little bit of a power now. Because oh. I can tell people that there's a new Star Wars coming up, and I can tell people that no one else was as excited about this stuff as I was.
Sure.
People were just like, yeah, okay. And then from then I loved movies. Movies were, my parents were quiet. Well, my family was quiet. I won't say my parents were quiet because my parents were quiet. But my family was quiet.
How many brothers and sisters do you have?
Zero.
Oh, so it's your parents and you.
Yes. Okay. And not only that, but I grew up, this is wild, I grew up on a municipal airport. So in a town of Sand Springs, Oklahoma, has a population of 12,000, 14,000, whatnot. And we have a small municipal airport, a private aviation airport. In case the Tulsa airport can't take people or for people that just have private airplanes.
Okay.
And instead of hiring security, my dad, who's the general manager of Sand Springs Pogue Airport, still has been for 30 years or so at this point. Instead of hiring security, they went. The family story goes, we can just get you a house instead. And so they brought a double wide out to the airport, and that was my childhood home. And from one to whenever I left for college, that was my home. I lived on an airport.
Wow.
Yeah.
So no neighbors except for planes.
No neighbors except for planes.
Was there a lot of action there, or was it like loud? You're hearing it all the time, planes in and out, or was it like not a lot?
No, it's kind of uneventful.
Huh.
Yeah, because it was just private aviation.
Sure.
Not very much happening.
Yeah.
No throngs of people. The lobby is probably smaller than the lobby that we're currently in right now.
Well, it's a hotel lobby. That's a different kind of place.
It's kind of uneventful. So I had my family's quiet. no kids to really fraternize with from Monday to Friday. So TV was there. TV was always there. TV would give me the stimulation. TV would give me the conversation that I didn't get, and I was always a really lonely kid. But TV was always there for me. Movies were always there for me.
Yeah.
And then on weekends, my parents would send me off to go be with my grandmother, who did live with in a proper neighborhood, and there were kids around there. But the kids were kind of vicious.
And kids are vicious all the time, yeah. Everywhere. So yeah.
And I don't know if you can construe this from the way that I'm talking now. Kind of a soft boy. I wasn't ever really an active kid. I'll take that back. There's a period in high school where I walked around a bunch. But literally that's, well, I guess I did marching band, but I was never actively seeking out running and whatever else kids do. I played
solid walking and marching.
Yes.
Yeah.
But even then that was never something that I enjoyed. It was like I was doing a checkbox. I guess I did it because that's where my friends were, but at the same time, I was so dedicated to doing it the best that I could, just out of a sense of duty and obligation. But I didn't enjoy it.
Hey, man, if everybody in the world had that kind of, like, effort put into the work that they do, I didn't enjoy it, but I wanted to do it the best I could, the world would be a better place.
Sure. Well, thank you.
Nobody in the world does this. Yeah. Like I'm always like, hey, listen, I get that your job isn't, like, rocket science or the thing that you were meant to do, but if you just do the things you're supposed to do, that's it, no more, no less.
Yeah.
You'd be doing everyone a great service because you do the job. You know, it's like, no. I say anybody, it's an excellent life lesson, I think, to do something you don't like and try to do it the best you can.
That's, I think I've gotten better at trying to relieve myself of that obligation the older that I've gotten.
Sure, but I think that there's a lot of trouble in adult life when people start getting resentful of having to do the thing that everybody has to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, you know, you can be mad, but literally everybody has to have a job, and literally everybody has to pay rent. And, like, you know, yeah, sure, it's easier for some people than other people, but it's a different situation.
Yeah.
Like, and you don't want to be in their situation any more than you want to be in your own, so just do this and then find the pockets of niceness. I mean, you know, life is a long time. It can't always be great.
Life is a long time.
Right?
Yeah.
We're much older than we could have been in previous generations.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
So you're in marching band with your pals. You're doing that. Did that get you sort of active in the high school? Was this high school that you're doing marching band?
Yeah.
And that was just like you and your friends, you hung out, you did marching band.
Yeah.
I'm assuming none of your friends who are in marching band are currently playing instruments and symphonies anywhere.
I don't think so.
Yeah, no. I don't know anyone that's taken marching band and then, like, it led them to a career.
Yeah.
So I feel like, hey, just enjoy it while you can. No one's ever going to ask you to hold a tube on march again.
Yeah.
Go for that.
Yeah.
Go for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So after you're a marching band enthusiast and you're, as it were, and you're leaving, you know, you're going to college, where do you go to college? How do you get out? What's your game plan when you're, like, given the freedom?
Whenever I make big life decisions, it's always because I'm pushed into a corner. After I graduated from high school, I went to community college for a year because I thought that I was going to be with my high school girlfriend forever. So I didn't bother. I didn't bother to apply to anywhere else because this was it. It's time to settle down. This is it. And she broke up with me. Quite wisely, the January of my graduating year, she's like, we're in high school. And I was like, but no, this is forever. Don't you understand? What did I do? So I did a year in community college, and then I don't remember what happened, but I know that one of my friends was going off to University of Oklahoma, and I secretly went, okay. Much to my parents' shock, because they're like, what are you talking about? You want to go to OU? Why didn't you tell us? we've helped you. And I don't want to ask for anything because I just don't want to be an inconvenience. Or at least back then, I think I asked for more things now. But I figured that I would do all of this stuff myself because I just didn't want to inconvenience them. It's not even a matter of wanting to just them not supporting me because I could not have had more supportive parents. But I just internalized all of this stuff to the point where I just didn't want to inconvenience anyone.
Huh. Why don't you want to inconvenience people? I love inconveniencing people. Again, I'm from Boston. It's part of me.
Sure. I don't know. I don't.
They didn't like give you, they weren't like, hey kid, you're bothering me, and that led you to think all the time you were a kid it was a problem?
Something that I've learned later in life is that whenever certain members of my family want something, they will talk their way around to it, and they will get the other person to say that they want this thing so they can achieve it. I remember being in a situation with a family member where it was very clear that they were cold in the car. I was driving them around, and it was very obvious that they were cold, but asking for anything is just the worst. So they went, is anyone uncomfortable? And just as a lark, I went, I'm good. I'm like, and so I just sat there, and they're kind of just shifting around. And I think 5 minutes go by, and I go, you know what? I think I'm a little cold. Let me turn the heat on. And they go, thank you so much. So I think it might be that.
Huh.
And subconsciously, me just pushing all of my needs down and just to make sure that they are happy.
Huh.
But I hate asking for things.
Still now?
Everything for me is a series of microtransactions.
Huh.
Even in the pre-interview, my mind is racing, going, do I need to talk a little bit more? If I talk right now, will Amy be a little bit mad at me for talking? Of course, no, because that's what a conversation is. A conversation is a series of just saying things and enjoying people. But for me, it's just everything has a cost. And I'm so involved with myself making sure that people are perceiving me correctly and making sure that the person that I'm talking with is not upset with me in any way, or if they're vibing with me, or hopefully that they're thinking that I'm the greatest person that they've ever talked with. That's every conversation that I have.
Sure.
I think. I hope I'm not being hyperbolic, but that's at least the way that I frame it at this point in time.
I mean, I feel like hyperbolic is an odd phrase for the way we think about ourselves and our own brains. I feel like everything that we individually do to ourselves is crazy.
Yeah.
Like, and I mean that in the most don't get offended kind of way.
Sure, yes.
But, like, I just mean, like, it's a wild way that our brains process, and they're constantly like, do this, do this, do this, do this, do this.
Yeah.
Whenever I talk to other people personally, I become at ease because I'm like, I'm not the one that needs to worry about anything. I'm just like, okay, so this is me. If you don't like it, that's a darn shame for you. See ya.
I'm on guard. I'm so on guard.
Huh. Interesting. How did you then, we skipped. We're getting you into college.
Yeah.
When you get to college, your family's like, I didn't even know you wanted to go there. And you're like, see you later. Bye.
Oh, not even. They're as soon as we established that, they're like, let's do it. Let's get it done. Because they had no problem with me going to college.
Sure.
That's not a thing, but I just didn't want to bother them. So I go off to college, and they're sad because that makes sense because I'm leaving the nest. I'm only child. Yeah.
You never talk to them again. No, I'm sure
that's
you talk to them.
That's absolutely correct. I miss them terribly.
But it's broken now. We're
yeah.
We're apart forever.
No.
You go to college. Did you do theater in college?
No.
No, what'd you get a degree in?
Film.
Did you get a degree?
Film. I got a degree in film.
That's great. Is it a good school for film? Did you learn a lot of good things?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No, but...
Based on what you know now about filming?
Yes. Well, I knew that the big one would be USC, but I just was not good enough. or at least that's what I was telling myself, don't even try.
Oh, sure, sure.
Don't even try to go anywhere else. Just pick this one. And I went because someone else was going. I made one decision based off of what I wanted, and that was to move down here to Austin. Everything else has been a series of, well, I guess we'll do this. I guess we'll do this.
So you came here on your own?
Yes.
How did you get here?
Yeah, no, I'll tell you. It's fine. Because
I was like, you can make it sweeter if you'd like.
Sure. Yeah.
I retell 20,000 stories and they all make me look great.
Sure. No, because I was a bad person. I was a bad person in this relationship.
Oh.
Because of that exact same thing of not just telling someone that what I want, and instead just kind of going with the flow until things became just destructive.
Yeah.
I was in a relationship for 2.5 years, and she was great, she's delightful, and I was just marred with indecision because she said, "What's next?" And I went, well, at first, because the endorphins are flowing, I went, "I'm going to marry you," within the first month, because that's, again, just the kind of person that I am. And then 6 months in, I went, "Something's not right." And still to this day, I don't think that I could pin anything down. Of course, it's probably me going, I haven't done anything for myself, but I wasn't telling myself that. So 2.5 years in, July of 2017. I'm out at trivia with my improv buddies.
Your Oklahoma improv buddies.
My Oklahoma improv buddies.
We'll get there.
Yes.
We'll jump back.
And I hear that my current roommate now, Tyler Bryce, has a roommate opening. His roommate is leaving. I've always wanted to go down to Austin. My apartment lease is about to run up. And my girlfriend at the time is in Colorado. So I can look for a place where I was at the time, in Norman. Or I can move to Colorado, which is not something that I wanted to do, but I didn't have the courage to tell her that. Or I could go to this place that I've always wanted to go to. At the time where I was in Norman, I was working 6 days a week, probably. I had been working 7 days a week for a good stretch of time, just because I wanted to do everything. I was working at a video production company and also working at a radio station at the same time, and then also doing improv.
Radio station job was really great.
But there was no room to progress, because I don't know if you know this, Oklahoma City, not necessarily a film town.
Well, I don't know if you know this. Radio, not really upwardly mobile.
Not exactly.
Not really a thing where you're like, let me get to the top of the radio market.
You were in radio.
You really can't
do
it. No.
No. We'll cut that out.
You're fine. my husband did broadcast for a little while.
Oh.
But no, I never worked in radio. I've been theater all the way.
Really?
Yeah.
Who did radio in town? That's not important.
Lots of people.
Yes.
So
I feel like there's this confluence of things, and I'm lightly spiritual. I don't like to talk about it because spirituality is awful, and no one
awful.
It's never fun to talk about, unless it's one of those 1 or 2 a.m. conversations where you're able to vibe with people.
It is never fun,
it's never fun to talk about.
Really? I love it. That being said, I also love arguing. So that's...
I hate arguing. I hate having any difference of opinion. I'd rather just be quiet and just suffer in pain. Because at least I know that you're okay. I can internalize this stuff, but heaven forbid that you're uncomfortable.
Oh, good work.
But anyways, this confluence of events where I honestly think that God is giving me a signal to just get out. Go. Because all of these things have opened up at the end of my lease. I don't like my jobs. Or rather, my jobs are... They're dead end. This relationship is... I'm stuck. And then I just go, okay, cool. In 2 weeks, I'm moving to Austin. give my 2 weeks notice at both jobs, tell my girlfriend I'm moving down to Austin. The next day she texted me going, I guess we're done. Because even me going, I'm moving to Austin, I still didn't have the courage of going, I think we should end this. She did it for me.
By saying, I guess we're done?
Yeah. Or
was it long distance the whole time?
No, it was for the last 3 months. And I saw Dawn of the Planet of the Apes later that day, which is a great movie. Side note. And then packed up literally everything that I owned in my Ford Taurus.
Nice.
Attended Improv Festival Oklahoma 6, August 1st through 3rd. My lease was up August 1st, so I had to be moved out. But the festival was that weekend, so I was living out of my car. Well, I was living in a hotel with literally everything in my car, in a kind of a janky hotel.
Sure.
For 2 or 3 days. Paul Normandin from NR Prime helped me move down because I didn't have enough space in my car. So I went, I'll take some stuff, because Paul in NR Prime constantly goes up to Oklahoma, Chuy Zarate, John Bolden, a whole bunch of Austin improvisers were up there as well.
So you already had some connections to the people here doing improv.
I did. I remember talking to Jessica Arge that weekend as well.
About moving and becoming part of the community?
Yeah. And then I moved down here on August 3rd.
2017.
August 3rd, 2014. Yeah, August 3rd, 2014.
Oh. In your story earlier, you had said 2017.
Well, that was a lie. Like, I was lying to you.
August 2014.
Yes.
So you're on your fifth year anniversary this year?
Yeah.
All right.
And then I was volunteering at OOB by the end of the month, and then by the end of September, I was directing my first show at the institution.
Wow.
And even then, I was still going, I'm not doing enough. I need to be part of this community faster. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. I mean, I feel like I want to be part of this community faster is a much better impetus than, well, I'm not going to do anything because it'll inconvenience people.
Yeah.
It seems like a solid, good drive.
Yeah.
Versus one that's kind of holding you back.
Yes.
Or feeling like you're not, you know, quite in the right place.
Yeah.
You know, and you mentioned earlier, and I think it's funny that you brought it up under the guise of spirituality when you were like, I think God sent me signs. I feel like everybody says that kind of stuff, so yeah. I don't think that's very controversial. But I also actually think, you know, secular or religious, there's always signs. That, like, when you are ready, when your self is ready to move on to the next thing, everything tells you. And you either listen or you ignore it. But when you ignore it, you're almost ignoring it willfully. There have been moments, I'm sure, in your life, and definitely in my life, where, like, I'm sure the world is like, you need to stop doing this now. And I'm like, what? I'm not going to listen to that because I'm going to make a different decision, even though everything is clearly pointing at this.
Yes.
But I'm doing it not in a, like, it scares me. I mean, I guess it is scared, fear, that's stopping you from making that change. But it's nice that your stuff all aligned in such a way that made it easier for you to move on.
Yeah, it's a weird serendipity.
I have 100% been in situations where I had to break leases and change things and, you know, lose friends over, like, I'm so super sorry, I gotta go. Or, like, you know, all sorts of different things. Where it's like, when I first moved to New York City for the first time, I got a job while my roommates were on vacation. It was like spring break, and my two roommates were a couple, and they had gone somewhere, probably to Florida, for vacation together, and I got a call from a friend of mine that was like, hey, I have a job in New York City for you and an apartment. And I was like, I'll take it. I'll be there very soon.
What?
And I, like, packed up everything into my car and drove from Dallas, where I went to college, to New York City when, like, sent my, and this is pre, like, text. Like, I can't text my friends, like, P.S. I'm moving.
Yeah.
I, like, leave them a note and
that's insane.
They were, I was,
that's
like,
crazy.
I gotta go. And they came back and there was just my mattress there. And they were like, what's happening? And I was like, you can have that mattress and you guys can just live together and not worry about me. Because we didn't, like, they didn't need me to live there. It wasn't like, oh, God, we have no money now. Like, it was like, there's two of you. You're fine. But it was like, so crazy. We all just lived together because it was like post-college. It was right after college. We didn't know what we were doing, so we all got restaurant jobs.
Yeah.
And then it was like, by the way, I got this job. I'm leaving. Bye. And the greatest thing is she's one of my closest friends ever. She still lives here in Austin, married to the guy she was with at the time. And, like, they were so supportive. Like, they were like, yeah, do it.
That's
so
amazing.
Exciting.
That's amazing.
Didn't lose friends out of that one, but it was definitely a, like, middle of the night, emptied, like, my whole room into, like, the hatchback of my Ford Taurus.
Hey.
And drove far, far away. Just to start a new thing.
That's wild. That's such a big move.
Oh no, that's how I do it. If I'm not if I'm not going in the middle of the night really far away, it's not enough.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I need to make big change. I'm from Boston. I live in Austin, Texas. These are not close.
They're not.
No. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So previous to this move to Austin, I want to talk about your infusion in the Austin improv community for sure.
Yeah.
But previous to that, after college in Oklahoma, you had found the improv community.
I found improv in college.
Okay, tell me about how that was. You're a film major, you're not really doing theater, but somehow you get a performance book.
Well, I've always liked performing. As much anxiety as I have about one-on-one conversations, the thing that has always been the easiest thing for me to do is stand in front of people and entertain them. Always.
Like crowds.
Yes. Yep. The bigger the crowd, the more comfortable.
Me too.
That I am. Always.
Yep.
That was never a thing, but it's just I think it was just that blue collar mentality of, well, you should be working towards things that are sustainable. I did stagecraft in high school, but I never did theater. I made.
Can I reassure you that everyone thinks this? Everyone in every country I've ever talked to about doing theater or doing improv is like, I needed to do something like that was good and sustainable.
Sure.
My parents didn't want me to do this, so I got a job in accounting or whatever. Everybody thinks they have to have this backup plan.
Sure.
Everyone that I've talked to has this backup plan, but almost none of them need their backup plan.
Yeah. And it's not even that my parents were encouraging me to have a backup plan. They were never parents that were going, shouldn't you be doing this instead? 1,000% all the time they were going, yes, what can we do?
I'm trying to learn from your parents' parenting, but I just can't. I'm like, they're super supportive, great. Wait, he's still upset.
Yeah.
I guess we are who we are.
Yes.
Love performing.
Love
that's
performing.
What you're doing
and
in front of
so
big
I
groups.
See a flyer on the bus stop at OU saying improv auditions in October of 2008. And I go, oh, cool. Yeah, let's do this. And I think in the entirety of Oklahoma at that time, there were 4 improv troupes, maybe 5. I think there were 5. There was, and I could definitely be getting this wrong. There's Ham Wallet in Stillwater, Oklahoma. There was, I believe, Crayons in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
So they are naming these improv troupes.
Yeah.
The 4.
There was Everybody and Their Dog in Oklahoma City. And then in Norman, there was Red Dirt Improv and there was OU Improv. OU Improv being the college improv troupe. And I was auditioning. And so I auditioned for that and got in, and those improv shows were so often packed to the brim. We definitely had shows that were sparsely attended, but more often than not, every seat was filled. And we'd do 2-hour comedy sports light shows.
Okay.
Rock the house, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is the college big?
No. You can walk from one end to the other pretty darn quickly, which I think speaks about the size of the population. I don't know what the exact things are, but it's within Kenny walking distance. And Kenny walking distance, very short amount of distance.
But like there's enough people that like a big auditorium is filled with audience.
Yeah.
I went to a very small school.
Well,
it was definitely Kenny walking distance.
Kenny
could have walked around it 5 or 6 times my college, so
I won't
he could
say
not
that
fill.
And I won't say that it's an auditorium, but it was still like 100 people fitting into a room. And in Oklahoma, no one really likes to go do things after 5 or 5:30. Myself included. Myself and Heidi Rogers, my duo partner, went out for Improv Festival Oklahoma on 8, I think. 9? One of those. And we're in downtown Oklahoma City, which is so easy to navigate after 5. And she's going, where is everyone? Because she's lived in Austin her entire life.
Sure.
I'm going, it's 5:30. People are at home. They're asleep.
Because asleep?
Yeah. They're resting. They're inside. They don't want to do anything because they've worked all week. It's just not, that's not a thing that people go do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, noted. When I get tired and older, I'll move to Oklahoma.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Sounds great.
Property values are wonderful.
Really? Good to know. Good to know. Steve, you're in the college improv troupe.
Yeah.
And how is it like structured? Is there like a leader? Are they like teaching you things?
Yeah, there's an artistic director, and it was always supported on the thought that this is a learning troupe. We would constantly take people in and always go over a lot of fundamentals. And OU Improv got super lucky. It was started by people that were just really hungry for improv. And then at some point, they crossed paths with, his name, I believe, was Negan. I never met him in person, but he was a guy that studied at Second City. I went, you guys have improv? I studied at Second City. Can I help you guys? And so he just brought all of the Second City training there and spruced up OU Improv even more. And then once Negan left, my roommate, Tyler, we met at college. He was former education director at Comedy Sports, and then he moved to New York to do stuff at Pitt and UCB. He had 15 or more years of improv experience at that point by the time he went to OU, and he went, you guys do improv? I have all this experience. Can I teach you guys? And so got all of that stuff, and whenever I got around, it was an outrageously finely tuned machine that was just able to deliver jokes instantly. Things were so well paced. And they were able to sustain a long 2-hour show and keep the audience engaged throughout the entire
2-hour
thing.
Show? Wow.
Yeah.
I guess Comedy Sports is different because it's shorter.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of like a montage, and I'm like, wow, it's a long-ass show.
Well, even
I hear
then,
you.
The second halves would be long-form shows that could often get super abstract, not whose line is it anyway type things. The audience would just be like, I get this. This makes sense.
Hmm.
Well, granted, we'd have a platform of an hour of short-form games where we get the audience on our sides, and that second hour bust out the weird stuff.
But the beauty too of like an improv brain and the development of that kind of show is that all of the short form is priming the audience and priming the performers with information that then when it comes back in the long form, they're familiar with, so they feel comfortable by
yes.
it.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Beautiful. Oh, I love that. It's a perfect setup. It's a very smart like way to set it up.
I'm obsessed with show structure.
I'm into it.
It's so sexy.
I feel like it like mixtapes. And maybe you're a little young for that. But when I was a kid, I made mixtapes, and I would always craft like the order of the songs and like how they fed into each other and that kind of thing. And very recently somebody mentioned that as a way to put sketches together in a sketch show, and I was like, oh my god, like my brain like exploded.
Yeah.
And I was like, yes, because I do that, but I hadn't thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, oh my god, yes, exactly.
Yes.
And somebody even mentioned making yourself a playlist to write something. Like they were like, listen, if you need to get through this, you need to like create the playlist that you need it to be, and then write it. It's like, oh my god, that's so smart.
Yes, yes.
Like get you focused in the vibe, get you all that stuff. Like, man, I love it. I love that show structure stuff. How did you get into, you're into show structure, how did you get into directing and stuff? When you moved to town, you said you got right into directing. Did you start directing and stuff in Oklahoma, or?
No. But that confluence of filmmaker brain.
Yeah.
And then just all of the studying that I did there combined with improv and Well, additionally, I wanted to basically be as popular as I could be as quickly as possible.
When you moved to Austin?
And for me, that shorthand was directing, because directing equals power, and people could recognize that I'm a big deal at that time. And so I pitched the show Improv Anonymous, which I want to do it again, because different mind space, which is basically take an improviser, interview them candidly, then after, and for half of the show, and the other half, get shames from a bucket, or had a shame bucket from the audience, pick out a slip, see what the shame is, and then do scenes based on that, and then decompress those, going, how did this make you feel? Did this bring up any baggage with you?
That's an interesting format that has a very sort of mental health bent to it.
Yeah.
You seem to be very cognizant of your own like issues as you go through them. Do you think that helps you develop the show? And second question B to that A is, does helping other people help you?
What was the first question?
Just answer whichever one.
Sure.
Does helping people help you?
It should. But at the same time, there's just I'm constantly focused on other people's happiness, I feel like.
Okay.
Or I'm just really selfish at the same time, because I'm constantly going, how are they feeling?
I don't know how that's selfish, but okay.
Well, for me, just to run through that process in my mind, because I feel like it might be a narcissistic tendency, because I'm going, how do they feel about me? How do I look in front of them? And then I'm kind of obsessing about their happiness is a way to think about myself
even more. Yeah, I mean, yes. Everybody else is just a reflection of you. That's kind of the whole world's problem.
Yeah.
Is that nobody can see past themselves ever.
Yeah.
To the point where every person around them is either a reflection or like a negative reflection of themselves. Even the people you don't like, you don't like them because they're you in a way that you don't like.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard. But I wondered, because you've created this show, right?
Yeah.
And it clearly has a, like, I'm going to pull up... Not only are you doing this Improv Anonymous, mm-hmm. you also have another show, both of your podcast, both of which have a focus this shame.
Yeah, I guess
on these things that you like that somehow you need to feel bad about.
Yeah.
And hilariously, when I was on the podcast, I had a hard time coming up with something I felt bad about, because I don't feel bad about what I like.
Right, you're from Boston.
Right. We've established...
Yeah.
That's a thing that when you're from Boston, if you don't like what I like, fuck off. But you know what I mean? Like, but the idea is, I never think of it that way. Like, I'm like,
no.
But what I like is cool. And then I was like, okay, what do people harass me about? And I was like, okay, cool, dude, where's my car?
Yeah.
But that took me a while to get to, because I was like, what? I'm great. Everything I like is great. I don't know what you mean.
Sure.
So, but I just wonder, not that I don't have any negative thoughts about myself, but you know what I mean? Like, I find it interesting that you have these shows that are examining the idea of shame and the examining the idea of liking something amidst some sort of negative feedback.
Yeah.
Do you think that references back to your... you know, personal feelings about trying to people please?
I guess so. You're right.
Oh, you never connected them in your own mind?
Nah. I know that I love boosting people. One of the perpetual bits that I always do, so I find it slightly amusing, which are my favorite kinds of bits that people are like, what is that? Why is that? Do you think that's funny? And I'm like, yes, it is.
I do love those.
Yeah. Someone going, I'm going to get a soda, and I'm just going, great, you deserve it. You're queen. You should worship yourself. You deserve everything. And I'm like, cool, thanks. Yeah, I guess I do. But also, just, I'm so hard on myself all the time, and we're all so hard on ourselves all the time. Why not just like the things that you like and try to find what small amounts of satisfaction that you can get in your own life, man.
Yeah.
was. A thing that helped unlock me on my journey towards betterment is just accepting the fact that I would be angry or mad or sad, because those are not feelings that were exhibited whenever I was growing up. My childhood was a happy one, but also it was a happy one, if that makes sense. All the family stuff, all the things that I found out later in life were just pushed down a deep layer of hidden sediment that I was unpacked much later in life. So I never saw, whenever I saw madness exhibited, anyone being angry, it was always explosive. Whenever I saw sadness being exhibited, it was always explosive. So I think I always associate those things with, well, if I'm angry or sad, it's going to come out and it's going to be explosive, as opposed to just sitting there and going, no, just being sad. Don't try and correct this. What you're feeling is not incorrect. That's just the way that it is right now. Is there anything else that you need to unpack there? Do you need to achieve something that would actually make you not sad? I still work on that all the time, because our natural reflex is going, well, I'm sad, I need to get unsad as quickly as possible, because heaven forbid anyone sees me crying, it's going to make me weak.
Interesting. But you want to help other people feel better, and so you're helping them. Why don't you give yourself the same slack?
I'm different. Right?
Yeah, I guess you're right.
I'm different. Everyone else can be put up on pedestals, but it's that same thing of, if I'm not trying, then what's my worth? I am worthless if I am not perfect.
Oh, well, that's never going to happen.
I understand, but that's the fight.
I guess that's true.
Are you okay?
I'm just thinking about it. I'm just thinking about, like, this idea that, you know, we all are hard on ourselves, you know, and I'm sure when we look at other people, we give them so much more slack than we give ourselves.
Yeah.
Number one, it seems like your journey is one where you seem to be figuring it out.
Yes.
And just acknowledging that there's an issue is important.
Yeah.
But you also seem to be wanting to, and I think this is great and excellent for anybody who feels a certain way, is to be like, oh no, there must be other people like me. Let me help them deal with their own shame of liking or this or doing this or whatever shame it might be that ends up in the bucket. You know, and I like the Improv Anonymous, because in the anonymous groups, as they were, there's a lot of negative talk where they have to tell terrible things that they've done in order to slough it off and move forward from it.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting scenario
to
deal with that and try to use humor to break it down.
And at the same time, one of the things, this is just a pet peeve of mine, but it's that talk of, well, this happens to everyone. But for someone like me, I don't need to hear that, because I know that it happens to everyone. The fight that's going on right now is me going, I shouldn't feel this way, because everyone else feels this way. I need someone to come along and tell me that what I'm feeling at that moment is terrible and awful, and gosh darn it, you are going through a hard time. I don't need to hear that everyone else is going on with it, because that tells me, oh, cool, I need to calm down. That.
Oh, because everybody else is having a hard time, so you're trying to help them by chilling yourself out, as it were.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to help anybody if you're also being hysterical.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hear that. I do that a lot.
Someone coming along going, you're hysterical right now, and guess what? You need to be hysterical right now. You deserve to be hysterical.
I don't think people are that kind to one another, though.
I try so hard.
Yeah.
That's
the beauty of being in the improv community, I think.
It helps.
It definitely is. It's a yes community, and it's certainly, at least in this town, in Austin, it feels supportive.
I am so excited about the changing language of comedy and improv within this town. I am so excited about Cold Town Theater just took down their gong recently because someone said that's cultural appropriation. And I was like, that's interesting. Oh, I guess it is. And they just replaced it with a triangle or something like that. And even that tiny thing, it just... it might rub other people the wrong way because they're like, it's just a gong. But for me, I'm just so excited because it's going, great, there's a different way to achieve the exact same statement. And that's people just going, this might trigger you. We're trying to examine these other things. How can we do comedy that is socially conscious, that's aware of power dynamics? It's so exciting. Not just because it's going to help people, but just on a comedy nerd level, cool. We're going to figure out how to tell jokes different. We're going because jokes have been. If there's a way to be able to tell a joke in a different way besides the classic ways, that's so sexy. That's so exciting. And the brain being able to perceive comedy in different ways. This pervasive thought that has recurred is there a piece of comedy that can exist within a vacuum, a comedy that is just always a laugh without context at all? It's a nothing burger thought because there's no answer because everything requires context. But I just love the thought of the changing context, and comedy math is so exciting, and the changing formulas as well. It's so sexy.
I really enjoy that. When I teach comedy, like to teens and stuff, I do comedy camps and stuff like that. I always teach from a structure standpoint because I don't think there's one way for there to be funny. And I think, like you're saying, it's changing. And you have to be open to that. And you also have to be open to that generationally. We are in a group of, you know, like adults who are trying really hard to develop what's going on and make it better and react to the political atmosphere that we have as adults. But these kids don't have the same reaction because their world is different. They have a different viewpoint of it. In fact, they don't want to talk about politics at all. They think that's dumb. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I'll be like, well, what do you think about this thing that happened? And they're all like, yeah, my mom's worried about that. I'm not worried about it. And I'll say, why? And it'll be just like, that's just not something we need to worry about because we're not going to be mean like that or blah, blah, blah. And it's weird how there are certain truths that certain, like the group that I worked with this summer, were all very different. They had very different points of view about what was funny and what wasn't. But there were certain truths that they were like, yeah, well, no, we won't talk about that because it doesn't matter. Like politics to kids doesn't matter because whatever's happening in the world,
it's 40,000 light years away.
Yeah, it's just not infecting their lives. So I'm like, great, what affects your life? You know, and it's where you are as it goes, right? So it's good that you in your life right now are figuring yourself out and doing all this stuff, being part of a community that's like ebbing and flowing and changing, because you will be part of the next generation of teachers that show the new people that are coming up that were like, wait, it never occurred to me. What's going on in the world?
Yeah.
And then they're 18 and they're like, I need to learn how to do comedy in a different way.
Yes.
And you're there to help them with the new formulas.
There's something that is... Have you heard of the benign violation theory?
Tell me about it.
Cool. Have you heard
I've heard the phrase benign violation, yes, but I don't know what you mean by the benign violation theory.
Sure. So this... I think he's literally a comedy scientist at the University of Colorado. I stole this from a TED Talk, and then I was like, what? This is wild. Looked into it more. And basically going into why the heck do we laugh? Because it all comes from some sort of violation of societal norms, that breaking of tension. And whenever that tension of expectation gets broken, you're going to have one of two thoughts. One, if it's a straight-up violation of your space, you're going to scream in terror because it's awful. Your norm has gotten violated. Not only that, but it's a threat against you. It's a violation of your norm. Your body has been harmed. Or it could result in laughter where that expectation has been broken, but it doesn't harm you. I think the example that he gives is that someone comes along at you and holds a knife at you. That's a violation, so more than likely you're going to scream. But if someone does the exact same action, puts a rubber chicken at you or something that's actually funny, you're going to go, benign violation theory, and that's why humor happens in the first place. And that's so weird and elemental. Yes.
So did this person talk specifically about the conditions of the benignness? I don't know what the noun
sure.
for that is. But like so the idea of the comedy is building the tension and then just breaking it? That's what they mean?
The tension being we just expect society to function in these typical patterns. That's that constant tension that is going on within our lives. All of our societal patterns are just on a straight line. Mm-hmm. And then the comedy comes along and breaks that tension and you laugh and that's the release of that tension. Did I answer that?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I'm just wondering like how you put that into practice. Like how would you explain it in a classroom scenario? If you were going to get somebody to use that theory in writing comedy, how would you tell them to do it?
Mapping? The mapping exercise. You have them act out some sort of serious conversation that people would feel safe about. And people are just like, wow, that was really dramatic and really heartfelt. And then you go, great, now instead of confessing that you've been cheating on your wife, you're going to confess that you watched season 6 of New Girl without her. But you played exactly the same. I think that...
So then in that scenario, the it's the contrast between the emotional connection and the less seriousness of the topic?
I think so. Because you're treating watching New Girl season 6 with the exact same seriousness of playing it as a divorce. And
interesting. Yeah, I've taught that before, but I had never used the phrase benign violation or anything like that to like develop those kinds of ideas.
I don't even try to bring that up because why it's not going to achieve anything. Need to try and boil things down to its most elemental levels in order to give people the basic tools so they can perform comedy in a vacuum.
Well, sure. Mine's like contrast and 3 beats, and that's about it.
Yeah.
That's what I give them.
I think that's plenty.
You're good. You can establish a contrast between what you expect and what is going to happen.
Yeah.
Great.
But my brain is going, cool, but why does contrast work? Why does 3 beats happen?
Yeah.
Why are those things? I don't think that's things that you necessarily need to teach unless they're going, right, but what?
P.S. Teens will ask why.
Right.
Yeah.
Rad.
Yeah.
They're so much awesomeness. Man.
Sure. Well, also, you gotta remember these are theater teens.
Mm-hmm.
These aren't just teens.
Sure.
They're teens that signed up, agreed to, and continued to come to a theater class. There's a lot built into who those people are. I try to, whenever I meet my teens in the summer, I try to imagine what then the whole of their generation is like, but I also have to remind myself that they are one very specific group, right? Not everybody's like that.
Yes.
People who are generally taking the first step to take a theater class are going to be different than the hoi polloi that might not be so open to having these discussions.
There are so many improv idioms that I just take for granted where I'm in front of one of my classes and they go, go on. I'm like, You've not heard this idiom. What was the thing that I had to explain? Play to the top of your intelligence. That's one that.
Oh my God! Are you kidding me? There's like entire improv groups arguing that right now.
For sure.
Yeah.
And then I might just throw that note out offhandedly because I just want them to achieve a thing, and they're going, "Cool. What does that mean?"
I find that it means different things to different people.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, in any sort of scenario of a teacher, you can use that in different ways.
Yeah.
Whether it means content or just means, like, effort. Those are two different ways to look at it, but it's, you know, both.
Say that one more time.
A content or effort, like meaning like play to the top of your intelligence, meaning the character that you're playing isn't just a person who works in a video store. This person's an expert on all things video. They can tell you what the V, the H, and the S all stand for and why it's very important, because the character is funnier if they are an expert versus somebody who's like, I don't know, right? The other option of play to the top of your intelligence is...
That was still pretty funny, though. Whenever you said, I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know. But then the other option is play to the top of your intelligence. If I've been doing improv for 10 years and I play with somebody who is only been doing it for 2 years, I should not dumb down what I think I should be doing improvised way as an improviser to quote unquote help them. I should be the best and most highly skilled improviser I can be, and that will only help them in that scenario.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that.
Especially in this town where there's people that have taken classes like across the board, people who have been in so many different classes that even though they are kindly and sweetly taking this level one, they don't need this level one.
Yeah.
They're just taking their brain back to the basics so that they can learn it again. That person should not try to be less than when they're in a scene with a person who's never done improv before ever in their whole life.
Yeah.
They should be as schooled and as educated as they can be, because it only helps that other person to be a better improviser, to have a person to work with that has the ease and the ability to do the things that they need to do.
Oh, wow. I never thought about
that. Yeah, well, I mean, that happens a lot. Even in the beginning of our conversation, we're talking about the idea of making ourselves more accessible to other people by making ourselves less than, by creating a scenario in which it's like, no, it's okay, you're better. No, I've done this for 10 years. I'm pretty good at stuff. Like, I feel okay. I can. I feel like confident that I can accomplish a task, right? But in that scenario, you know, we all have different feelings. Oh, how should I be? Oh, I'm taking a level one. Maybe I should try to be, you know, focused on this thing or whatever. It's like, don't deny your own intelligence. Be the best person you can be.
Yeah.
And don't feel bad about that. So I think it just has different, that's in my opinion, two different ways to look at it. Cool. And again, I've read thread upon thread in improv groups about how to do it, because everyone has a different way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I also try to, when idioms come, I try to understand them in a larger way, especially since I've been talking to international improvisers.
Yes.
Because I forget how much of my language is idiom until I'm talking to somebody whose first language is not English.
So many improv lessons are all based on idioms as well, and then it kind of gets lost. Where I've been in classes where I'm just going, I don't know what to take away from this. It just kept repeating the same thing. I don't know what this means.
Yeah.
Playing slow. I felt difficulty with that note of slow down, which I've seen so many people go, oh, cool, I need to do less. I need to literally elongate things more.
Yeah, but giving that note and not providing an exercise in which you can do that, in which we're forced to do that, is a difficult situation. But
I feel like so many people do. Just give the general note, slow it down. Cool. What for someone
like,
that's
fresh.
But
the scene I did was the house was on fire. Yeah. Should we have slowed down? Actually, maybe you should have. Uh-oh, I just ruined my own example. You're right. If the house is on fire, what's funny? Not moving quickly. But see, this is how you get to comedy.
Yeah.
You have these conversations, you figure it out.
Yeah.
That's actually how I do the, when I teach the kids, we just have discussions. Where I'm like, okay, great, so this is happening. What's the funniest thing that could happen in this scenario?
Oh, man.
And then they brainstorm things. And I pull from the ones that say, okay, well, what about that? What if that happened?
That sounds great.
And they're like, well, that's weird. Yeah, it is. How can we make it weirder?
Yeah.
What would be weirder about that? You know?
That's awesome. That's lovely.
Sure. But I mean, I'm trying to pull comedy out of the most sarcastic humans in the world. So it's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough. Now, you do a lot of teaching here in Austin. Where are your like home theater or theaters?
My home base is the institution.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, when you came to town, you got connected. You were directing immediately. How did you get in and direct? Did you take classes there? Did you just swing in, shake a hand with Tom Booker, and he was like, I'll give you a show? I don't know how it works.
Sure. My last weekend in Oklahoma, I was taking a workshop with Jimmy Corain. And Jimmy, I was talking to Jimmy, and I told him that I was moving down to Austin. He went, you need to hook up with Tom Booker.
Great.
And then I think I just asked Tyler, do you know Tom Booker? And I received the first video message that I'd ever received on my phone, I think the only video message that I ever received on that particular phone, which was a video of Tom Booker going, hi, I'm Tom Booker, and I know Tyler Bryce.
Is it weird that I now want to make Tom Booker make me that same video?
No, I would recommend it.
I haven't interviewed him yet, I should.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the institution used to have pitch nights where literally anyone can come in and go pitch something. And they had a pitch night in September, and I wanted to do this show. And what Asaf Ronan told me is, because I had my pitch night, I was so fresh, but he could tell that I was really passionate about the darn thing. So they gave me a one-off.
Nice.
And then I did a couple more Improv Anonymouses here and there. I haven't done it in a very long time. And then just kept hanging out at the institution and still hanging around there.
Did you take classes with them, or did you just, you started out as a director and you moved forward?
I started out as a director, then I started taking classes at the institution.
Cool.
And
that got you into, eventually into the teaching faculty?
Yeah. Even then, I started teaching there last year. Yeah.
What do you like most about teaching?
Watching it click for other people. Being able to give them the elemental pieces of comedy and them going, oh, and they put those puzzle pieces together and then suddenly I'm watching a magic trick happen in front of my eyes. Also seeing the confidence come into them, because one of the things that I, as you might have surmised, I tried to infuse it with, don't worry about making the right choice, make the first choice.
Sure.
I don't think that that is a thing that should be applied blanket statement to everything, but a lot of people that come through the classes that I teach are people that are naturally just attacking themselves whenever they're on stage. And their biggest hurdle is just that hesitation, that 5 or 10 seconds of them thinking of an idea of what's happening. And meanwhile, they could literally be saying anything.
Anything.
It literally doesn't matter. I try to tell them, you have a natural authority because you're in front of people. Because people would rather die than talk in front of people. That's the thing. That's.
I know, I think it's just funny that you remind them of that.
Yeah.
You're doing is something other people are deathly afraid of. I'm like, ah!
I don't think that I've said that, but I should, because it's funny. But they're on stage, they have a natural authority, and I try to tell them, don't worry.
Yeah.
Which always works. You tell people, don't worry, they're going to stop worrying.
100%. 100%.
But just make the first choice, and I guarantee you that that will be fine. That's going to be fine enough. Fine enough. And just act like you would in real life. That's the thing that I feel like you need to unlock with fresh improvisers, because they just have to be comfortable being themselves.
And can I give you a tip on how to get them immediately comfortable with each other?
Please.
When I teach level one improv the first day, we don't know each other, right? We're all just a bunch of strangers. So after I do a couple warm-ups, I make them do scenes. I'm like, scenes already? And I'm like, yeah, but it's not going to be a big deal. We're going to do getting to know you scenes. The two of you guys are going to go up there and talk to each other about your actual lives. Go. And the rest of us will just watch. But you guys are just going to talk. And they're like, what? Yeah, just meet each other. We don't know each other.
Yeah.
Where are you from? What do you do? That kind of stuff. Go ahead. And then they're like, they talk. We all listen. And they're like, that was boring. And you're like, who says it was boring? Did you enjoy that? Yeah, I thought it was fun. I didn't know that stuff. That you work in a specific kind of accounting? Who knew there were different kinds of accounting?
Yeah.
I didn't know, you know.
Oh, that's thrilling.
You know,
I
things like,
it.
Like that. Like the little tidbits of people's lives. Because we're all fascinating because we think we're dumb because, you know, we're the only thing that we see.
Yeah.
Then they start talking. And then you're like, great, you guys just all did scenes. And they're like, that's it? That is it. That is it. Later, we're going to talk about tips and tricks to make them funny. But right now, I just need you to open your mouth and speak to one another. And we need to establish a level of trust. So in order for that to happen, we need to know about each other. So let's do that.
Yes.
Like, and once we're friends, and it establishes two things. One, puts people personally at ease with one another. And then two, it creates a basis of information that we then have so much to go from. Mm-hmm. Right? One last question, and then I'm going to let you go on to your exciting day. When you are teaching, we were talking before about hitting a wall, but you're leading people. When your students hit a wall, what do you tell them? When they are like, I'm stuck, I don't know what to do, I can't do this, I'm not going to, what would you say to a student who's begging you to help them get out of their block?
sometimes they straight up ask, what do you need?
What do you mean, what do you mean? What do you need?
Is there literally something that I can do in this immediate circumstance which can help alleviate your anxiety? Because I could put people through exercises that I think are fun, but that might compound that anxiety as well. I play very fast and aggressively because that's the most fun. And one of my favorite things that I've learned is whenever I play fast and aggressive, that might put other people way into their heads because they don't feel safe.
Yeah.
Even though I'm not coming at, I subconsciously I might be coming in as a place of, cool, I'm dominating. This is the thing that I'm good at. But really, I just want to play and I want you to make mistakes with me. So I might literally go, what do you need? Or I might run exercises similar to what you're saying, which is just get them to be themselves. One of my favorite exercises is break room, the break room exercise, where I just give them the instruction, be the most boring versions of yourself, because I guess that's just the way that the exercise works. Just be the most boring versions of yourself. And then I know that I know that things are going okay whenever I see a student check their mime cell phone and they're just looking down and they're not engaged with anything. I'm going, cool, they're feeling good. I just hopefully try to construct things that remove the theatricality of the thing and just get them to just be themselves.
Yeah.
Because I think if they're on the stage, there is a reflexive interest in what the heck that they are doing, because it's blown up. You're suddenly paying attention to every single thing. Every single thing that they're doing on stage, the brush of the leg, the flip of the hair, every single thing gets blown up. So someone being boring on stage or being themselves the least interesting things, there's an artistic statement that comes out of it. I hope that I can get people to understand that. I don't think that I'm always successful, but I sure try.
You know, that's okay. A lot of times when I'm talking to people, I'll ask them what their jam is, like what the thing that they've been thinking about is. But it seems to me that that is kind of yours. You know, you're like trying to help people get to their best selves.
Yeah.
And a lot of what you've said and a lot of the stories seem to indicate that you're trying to help people get to be better selves and like get in touch with their own functioning anxieties and try to have fun.
Yes.
And that seems to be the key for, you know, most of improv. But just from listening to you and hearing the stories and what we've talked about, I know we've gone down a few rabbit holes when it comes to like mental illness and anxieties and that kind of stuff. But I think that it's good because you seem to be tuned to your students and helping them navigate that. And if we need so much of that in our lives,
yeah,
like to have someone to hold our hands, because there's no one to hold your hand once you're an adult.
Yeah.
So it's great that you're there for your students.
Yeah. I like working with novice improvisers just because I think that I can relate to them better. I shudder at the thought of me being in front of experienced improvisers that are feeling really comfortable, because I'm like, you already feel good with yourselves. I can do diagnostic work, but really my abilities are, you could get someone else to achieve the same goals. Or show structure, or trying to blow up their show and starting it from the ground up. But I enjoy that self-help stuff, and I like helping to, I guess it just allows me to execute my armchair psychology. Without the benefits of having, without having to actually go to school.
Well, it's almost like we were talking about when we were discussing how the political landscape is a little rougher. So the artists are, you know, stepping up and trying to create a more, a comedy that accommodates, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And your position in trying to alleviate anxiety, both in shows and as an improv teacher, I think is just an example of that.
I really want to talk about this, and I got to get it in under the wire.
Get it in under the wire.
And some of my friends and acquaintances have probably heard me say this, but I just want to get this on the record so I don't have to talk about it anymore.
Okay.
But I'm going to because it's thrilling. I'm a big fan of Star Trek: The Next Generation. Anyone that knows me knows this. And one of the tenets of that show that the creator Gene Roddenberry came in is all these characters get along. There's no conflict between these characters. Your job as writers for me is to give me good stories that have no conflict. And every writer in Hollywood is going, how do you do drama without conflict? Ripping their hair out going, I can't do it. And as soon as Roddenberry died, Star Trek just started adding conflict because he wasn't around to tell them that. But seasons 3 through 5 of that show, you can see them wrestling on how to tell great stories, and they tell great stories where all of the characters agree with each other. That's point A. Point B, have you heard of this thing called, I think it's called Kisho Tenketsu?
No.
Cool. My friend David Moses Fruchter posted this thing from Tumblr, and I'm obsessed with it. And it's drama without conflict. It's a form of Eastern poetry. That says drama is not conflict, drama is contrast.
Yeah.
Which is thrilling, but the Western ideal of telling stories is always people overcoming something. And
sure.
this Eastern philosophy is we're not overcoming, we're just coming together. The example is a between Western philosophy and Eastern philosophy. It's a 4-panel comic. Panel one, Amy Jordan comes upon a soda machine and puts a quarter in. Panel two, the machine eats the quarter. Oh no, you can't get a soda. Panel three is you shaking the soda machine. Panel four is you getting that soda successfully. Western storytelling. Under this poetic structure of Kisho Tenketsu, panel one is still Amy Jordan putting in the quarter for the soda. Panel two is you getting that soda. Panel three is someone just sitting on a lawn. And panel four is you coming along and sharing that soda with the person. And to me, and I would love to be able to do some sort of improv show and play in this narrative structure. Because I go, oh, the tension is not how are they going to overcome this. The tension is how do these two things connect. So now I'm on the edge
of my seat
going, oh, this is... I'm interested because I'm going how there's an assumed context that these things are connected. Now, how are these things going to connect? And I just watched My Neighbor Totoro, which functions on this structure of Kisho Tenketsu. I think where most of that movie is just completely conflictless. To bring it all together. So much of Western society is fighting against each other. We have to overcome this. We have to overcome that. We have to prove our worth. We have to prove our strength. And we participate in these strength narratives with the movies that we consume, the TV we consume. There's always, if not a villain, there's some sort of force out there, be it tangible or intangible, that we're trying to overcome. And I would like to engage in narratives where we're just going, this is fine. Let's just be here. And the interesting things in life are just making the connections with other things in our life, because that is also interesting. You being stronger or you having gone through adversity is not interesting by its own. There are other ways to achieve work. I'd like to do that in my improv. I like to do more drama equals contrast. I like to do more comedy equals contrast. Well, I guess comedy does equal contrast. But try and eliminate that conflict aspect of it and just go, let's just hang out, man.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I'd be interested to know, like, what the Star Trek writer or producer's effort was. Like, if he was older in his life and he realized that conflict was not something we had to deal with, so that's why he was like, guys, we got to put this out there in front of everyone.
I could easily talk for another hour just about that.
Did you do a lot of research on his reasons?
I'm a huge Trek nerd. Roddenberry had two successes in his life. One was Star Trek. The other one was Star Trek The Next Generation. He never did anything else in his life, but Star Trek was so outrageously popular that he was able to sustain himself by just lecturing and taking around Star Trek tchotchkes and going, here's the original pilot of Star Trek. I bet you guys like to watch this. And 2,000 Star Trek fans are like, yes, there's more Star Trek. There's hidden Star Trek.
It's funny because isn't that kind of the dream? And almost to the point of what you're talking about with this, like, non-conflict, he wrote a thing. It was a success.
Yeah.
He rode that success to the end.
Well, the original piece had fighting, and there was sexiness and all of the things that would be associated.
Sure, he was 20 when he wrote it.
He was actually in his 40s. Gene Roddenberry was a terrible, terrible, terrible guy. And then, awful.
He's terrible, eh?
Horrible, yeah. Womanizer, alcoholic, had a massive drug problem. And all of these, nothing was healthy in his life. Very combative with everyone. No one wanted to work with him.
Oh.
At least no one studio-wise wanted to work with him because he kept trying to get things off the ground. People were like, I don't want to work with this guy. He's just going to fight us at every turn because everything is a fight with him.
Sure.
And then I think because he put himself in an echo chamber of Trekkies going, you are God. He went, maybe I am God. What else do I think about the future? Well, I think we'll just have stuff figured out. I think by the 24th century, there will be no hunger, there will be no greed, and everyone will just get along.
Certainly an interesting thing to think about.
It's fascinating because I love that. I love that aspirational philosophy.
Sure.
And it just comes out of someone that is just a genuinely awful person, but at the same time, there's at least one person on this planet who was actively perpetuating this. No, I think we're going to be okay, and not only are we going to be okay, we're going to have it figured out.
I wonder, too, if the difference in storytelling comes from, old country versus new country, mm-hmm. meaning, in the U.S., we're real combative, and we're real like, oh, fuck you, I'm the best.
Yeah.
And there's also, a lot of, be happy for yourself. The American dream isn't, all of us get the American dream. One dream for all of us. It's like each of us individually are supposed to get our own dream.
Yeah.
Which is a ridiculous idea ever.
Yes.
That everyone would get their dream, right? And so perhaps it is, older cultures who have gone through that and been like, yeah, that's not the way to live.
Yeah.
Are like, but the longer flow of it, if you just stay the course.
Yeah.
But I do like the part of the storytelling that still has a little bit of intrigue, meaning who's this random person? What's this random situation? Oh, I see how they're connected all of a sudden.
Yeah.
I love those things.
Yeah.
That's super interesting.
Yeah.
Great. Later, I'm going to need you to write down the name of that because, in fact, I'll probably make you write it down in my notebook right now.
Sure.
The name of that theory, because it sounds like a unpronounceable or something I would not spell correctly.
Certain. And I'm certain.
But I'd love
to
research that
I'm
kind of stuff.
That I'm getting it wrong. I haven't found any other pieces of literature. I just want to learn about other storytelling formats because that's just fascinating the way that we perceive narratives.
Totally. Totally, and different. I love the idea of different cultures telling stories different ways. I actually personally really enjoy looking at the movies that are coming out and trying to reflect on what their message is with reference to what just happened in the world. So, right after 9/11 is when all of the Marvel superheroes came back.
Yeah.
Because we needed them. We needed someone to save us.
Yeah.
Even the idea of Captain America, that story came out right around this time when we needed to know that the little guy could do it.
Yeah.
And even though in our purely American, of course, way, we had to pump him full of drugs to get it to happen.
Yeah. Outside of maybe a handful of examples, not only that, but we're putting our hands in the form of quasi-military fascists.
Right.
And we're going, no, they've got our best intentions in mind.
Of course they do.
Tony Stark is a privatized military man.
Yeah.
Who is going around just blowing stuff up. And our American society is just like, he makes jokes. That's cool.
Can I just say that the from the beginning to the end of the sort of Avengers arc,
yeah.
The Tony Stark journey is, I believe, what people hope all of us can achieve, going from money-mongering, personal, caring only about ourselves, totally egomaniacal, to this, like, heart-central father figure person who saves the world and, like, cares for us all with his open heart.
Yeah.
Like, that's what we all hope our lives could be.
Yeah.
I would love to be older and have achieved that, right?
Yes.
So I love looking at storytelling and trying to see, based on what movies are coming out, what things are going on, what we are learning, what different things are going on. Even when I think there's mistakes being made, I try to examine what why they were made.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, ooh, I noticed they still did this. I wonder why they included that thing when it's totally out of favor now. The other thing about movies, which is a crazy thing, is they're like 2 or 3 years in the background. There are movies that are trying to come out right now that can't come out because they're not cool anymore. Because the topic of what they were about is like gauche.
Such as?
There's a movie coming that I don't know if it'll even come out, made by Blumhouse, that is literally about
is it the
liberals?
Hunt? Are you talking about The Hunt?
Maybe The Hunt is what where there's a bunch of liberal people who get guns and then shoot conservatives in a put you on land and then hunt the craziest game kind of scenario. And when they started to release that it was going to come out and they put out like a preview or something like that, there was an uproar like, fuck that, no way, we don't want that. There's enough gun problems in the world. You're going to make it so that it's like cool now to murder people because you disagree with them politically?
Yeah.
You cannot put this movie out. It's absolutely unacceptable.
Yeah.
And I'm like, guys, Blumhouse is the same company that created The Purge. How is The Purge different than this? Because The Purge, everybody's fair game, whereas this has specific rules, so now you're like, you can't say that. You can kill everyone, but you can't kill one specific group, which is probably true. But it's also like just a wild thing. Like, it's like, this group is known to do these wild things. Why wouldn't you expect them to do such a thing?
Yeah.
They're even trying to push buttons from all sorts of things. Like, I'm fascinated by horror in the same way that I'm fascinated by comedy, because I think they're both pushing against what is okay, what is acceptable, what are we really afraid of, what really will make us laugh when the world around us is terrible. The hard thing about comedy these days is that it's like, how do you even make a joke when, like, it could become true? I read an article about a sketch group that was doing a sketch show for MTV or whatever, and they kept having to cancel the sketches because it would actually happen. Like, it was a political satire show. And, like, the day before their sketch about this terrible thing happening, it would actually happen in real life.
Yeah.
And they were like, ah, why? We thought this was third beat. And it's not. It's the world now.
Yeah.
Right? So, I don't know.
I've been... Ever since Trump got elected, I've been wondering, how do you do... You can't do political comedy. You can't do political comedy because, going back to benign violation theory, it's all violations. There's nothing funny about it.
Yeah, it's tough.
He's locking people up for just being not white.
It's not all right.
Yeah, everything is a violation. So how do you do satire? And I think... horror films have been such a catharsis...
Yeah.
In a way that comedy cannot be, which is probably why horror has seen such a recent uptick. Then not only that, but just the combination of actually having strong horror voices, people actually having something to say. And then being able to see that dread articulated on screen and then having some sort of catharsis in the end, because they can achieve something that you can't at this point in time. The only good piece of satire that I've seen was Sorry to Bother You, and even that was written before Trump even got elected, but watching this and going, oh, this is how you do it, because they're not talking about any specific thing, they're talking about systems, they're talking about capitalism, they're talking about...
Oh, Sorry to Bother You goes from zero to what the hell is happening so fast.
Yeah, it takes...
I loved that movie.
because the things that we thought were previously unreal are all now reality, so of course you have to blow it up. Too sorry to bother your proportions, and aren't even a comment on the darn thing.
Indeed. Indeed. People like went too far. We're like, okay, but it was real life until it went too far, huh?
Yeah.
It was like, I have lived that life for a long time.
Yes.
That exists.
Yeah.
People getting things they shouldn't get for no particular reason other than breaking rules. Yeah, that's a thing.
Yeah. Yes.
Their friends being mad because they're breaking the rules they previously stood against. Yeah, that's a real thing.
Yeah.
Where's the comedy? Get us there, right? Yeah. That's the hard part.
Yeah.
That's the hard part of storytelling, especially in this world when it's like, I can't even imagine. That's why I think the kids avoid it. Because, like, my mind is blown daily about things that are like, how is that even real? Right? But it is. It's real.
Yeah.
So I'm going to wrap it up because
sure.
I think your time is worth it. You need to go live your life.
Well,
I
have to record an episode of my podcast.
So many podcasts.
Afterwards. Yeah. Going to go watch all the Matrix movies.
After
this, and then record a podcast that starts in 45 minutes.
Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast and chatting with me and sharing all your stuff.
This is such a big deal. This is such an honor.
Oh, you're so nice.
I'm not being pleasant. I just feel like anyone that's on this episode automatically is like, oh, cool, they have the status symbol.
Oh, to be on the podcast?
Absolutely.
That's so nice. That's so nice. I hope so. I try to make sure that I'm talking to everybody, as many people as I can. You know anybody that's... that would be good. Please let me know because, you know, I'm just interested in the journey.
Yeah.
I'm just interested in sharing the journey with everybody because I know, audience, you're all on a journey. And maybe somebody that I talk to has a similar one and you feel less alone.
Yeah.
That's all I want.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Good.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.